Grateful that you're hanging in with me and looking at these defensive weapons. In this lecture, we're going to look at the last of the defensive weapons, and then we're going to turn to the offensive weapons that we're given and in ways that we can tear down strongholds, and we're going to be looking at all that. But today we look at the last piece of defensive weapon, which is the helmet, the soldier's helmet. Now, this is a picture of my bike helmet. And it's a very important thing. It's a Schwinn, and I love to bike, and so I put on this helmet. In fact, I would consider it a law now to put on a helmet, because there are certain facts about wearing this kind of helmet when you're biking, and here are some of them. Reduce the risk of head injury by 45% to 85%. Reduce the risk of a serious head injury by 69%. Reduce the risk of severe traumatic brain injury by 74%. 62% of cyclists killed in 2019 were not wearing helmets. Wow. And that means even though there's no significant quality difference between expensive and cheap, 843 bike riders were killed in crashes with motor vehicles in 2019. In other words, if you don't have something protecting your head, it's going to affect your ability to live, because the head's a rather important place, right? Where the brain is. Well, look at the helmet. This is the scripture passage again, and you can read that first part. But he says, in addition to all these other defensive weapons that we've been looking at, he said, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all of the flaming arrows of the evil one, and take the helmet of salvation. The helmet of salvation. Now, here's a picture of a Roman helmet. It's one that has been recovered. It's been dug up. Obviously, it's a little tarnished here and there, but that's okay. Now, the helmet obviously covered the head. Now, with the shield, you've got your body almost all covered, except for a little portion up here. And so the helmet had these parts to it. Had the covering of the top, and it had this thing that went back down to cover the back of your neck. This to cover your neck here the sides of your face. And the whole purpose of the helmet was to protect you against a blow of a sword. Now, the helmet was designed not just to deal with the short sword. We're going to talk about differences in sword eventually when we get to that. What does it mean to take up a sword? But there's a particular kind of sword that this was designed to protect against, and it was called a broadsword. Here is one that's from the Berlin Museum. It was found in 2013 and was placed there. But you'll notice the broadsword is not this little. The Roman sword, as we're going to see, was about 2 feet long. This is a huge, long thing. It was heavy. And the way you wielded the sword was to pick it up and then to crash it down onto the head of your enemy. And the whole idea is if you could disable the enemy's head, you'd win. And so there is a helmet that's necessary. And these helmets were designed so that they were rounded, so that there would be a glancing blow if somebody came at you with this kind of sword. Now, the big question when we're looking at this shield, this helmet of salvation and the shield of faith, but the helmet, is how in the world do we put on this helmet? Now, for the Roman soldier, this would be the last piece of armor that you'd put on. You'd take the belt of truth, you'd put on the breastplate of righteousness, you'd make sure your boots were in place and that they were tied tightly. You would pick up your loins and put them into the belt, and you would gird up your loins, and then you'd have the shield there, you'd take up your shield, and you'd have a servant come bring you your helmet, and that helmet would be put on you, it would be tied tightly, and then it would be adjusted so that you are protected. It would be the last thing you put on, because this is important. It protects your head. Now, that, of course, is a metaphor, as Paul is looking at the army soldier. He's not saying, go get yourself a brass or a helmet. What he's saying is that the helmet protects your brain. And it's the helmet of salvation. It protects the way you think. The enemy is going to come at the way you think. He's going to come at you with a sense of what he wants to accomplish in your life to twist your thinking. And so we've got to consider how we think. Here's from Romans chapter 12. Paul says, "Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will." Now, a couple of images in there that I want to look at with you when it comes to our mind, the way we think. The first is that idea of, you know, don't be pressed into the pattern of this world. When I lived in California, I had a section of my yard that just couldn't grow grass in, and so I was considering putting in a patio. And I went to Home Depot, which is a home improvement store that's popular in the United States, and found you could get these molds. And the whole idea is you mix some loose concrete and you put it in there, you press it in there, you trowel it out, and you wait for it to dry, and then you can take that form off and you can go on to another. But the whole idea is of being pressed into something. My kids used to play with Play-Doh, and they used to have these forms that you could make. You wanted to make a truck, here it is. You just press it into a form. The whole idea of this passage that Paul is saying is there is a pattern in this world, and the enemy is the prince of this world, as you've seen. He's the prince of the power of the air. He's got power, and in this world, he's trying to get us conform to the pattern of this world in our thinking. Now, that brings up a question, of course. What is the pattern of this world? Now, most of us have a tendency to go to behaviors right away. You know, well, this is the pattern of the world. When I was in high school, somebody came up with this little jingle for girls. Say, "I don't smoke and I don't chew and I don't go with boys who do." In other words, you know, I'm going to look at the behavior and say, is this behavior the right kind of behavior? But Paul is not talking about, you know, just going to movies, playing cards. We used to think those were the really bad things. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a way of thinking that is predominant in the world. Now, I've been thinking about this, and I want to suggest, you know, four ways that the world thinks that are part of what we battle and why we put on a helmet of salvation, that the story of the gospel is true. The first one is secularism. The only thing that matters is the here and now. In other words, you wanted to believe there was a heaven coming and you're living because, you're saving up crowns in heaven, whatever it is. No. Secularism said there's nothing beyond the here and now. Carl Sagan was one, he had a series on public television here in the United States, and it began this way. He would say, as he's seated in front of this beautiful view of all these planets and stars, he said, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." That's secularism. The belief that I'm trying to be good, well, why? You know, where do these values come from? We would say they come from the Judeo-Christian heritage, right? There's an understanding of what's right and wrong. In fact, you know, we're not going to talk about that in this series a great deal, but, you know, that idea of a moral law that's implanted here. A secularism would say, no, that's true. That's not true. In fact, that's one of the evidences. I just finished a book by a scientist who came to Christ. He was an atheist, but came to Christ because he began to look at the world. And he said, it can't have happened by accident. There are too many little tiny variables that a human being could not be if just one little thing was off. And so he became a Christian because of that. And that led him to believe that there is a God who was existing before the world was created, and a God who loved him and speaks to him. And this man is brilliant. He holds multiple degrees in medicine, but in biology and chemistry, and he's been a speaker. He's led major organizations, but he wouldn't have done it if he was a secularist. He wouldn't have experienced faith to the degree if he just stuck with that, what he began with. He was an atheist. He believed the cosmos is all there is or all ever will be. That's something of the pattern of this world. Another part of the pattern of this world is humanism. In other words, don't look for meaning outside of yourself. And here's a graphic I saw, what a humanist thinks. They said, our lives and the world are ours and ours alone. That's no part of it. A departure from tradition is a product of critical intelligence. In other words, you don't do things just because you did them. There was a reason back then. No. A humanist says, no, now. The future comes with the yet to be known. Values and ideals can change as knowledge changes. Happiness comes from working to benefit society. In other words, we try to be good, but it's not because of some God we're trying to serve. No. We believe that human beings are the top of the order in the world. Weren't created that way, it just happened. And so that's a way the world thinks. Here's a biggie for the world, a moral relativism. In other words, the belief that there are no absolute truths. Here's what moral relativism means. It's the position that all points of view are equally valid, that all truth is relative to the individual in his, her, or environment. All ethical, religious, political, and aesthetic beliefs are truths that are relative to the cultural identity of the individual, and it can include moral relativism, and in other words, ethics that are relative to the social construct, situational relativism, right and wrong, depend on the particular situation, and cognitive relativism. Truth is relative, has no objective standard. This is huge in the pattern of the world. I was reading one man in preparation for this class who talked about being on a plane and engaging the woman sitting next to him in conversation over a period of time. And he began to talk about, you know, what he believed as far as, what he believed about marriage. And that conversation went that quickly to that place as this woman was preparing to get married. Anyway, he described what he believed about marriage, that God created man and woman, and that they would come together, and that they would commit to each other for life, etc. And her response was, well, that's your opinion. And he described something else, and she would say, that's your opinion. And he came back to say, no, but it's, what's the truth? Is it true? It's not just my opinion if it's true. Moral relativism says everything is your opinion. And society has put some constructs on that, has put some, barriers to it, but otherwise, there's no right and wrong. There's no ultimate truth. It's just whatever you happen to believe and people around you believe. And so moral relativism is one of the molds that the world tries to put us into. And then finally, materialism. The more you have, the happier you'll be. That's a huge, huge, huge one. Okay, so let's look at this from a scriptural point of view. Romans, he says, I urge you, don't, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world. Don't be pressed into that. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. A couple of words there to be aware of. Transformed means metamorphosis. In other words, as our minds are engaged correctly, we're going to change. And the word here means, metamorphosis. This is a monarch butterfly in the chrysalis about to come out. There's something that happens when this caterpillar spins this chrysalis. It's a caterpillar, and it comes out a butterfly. What all changes in there? Scientists have studied this, and it is a marvel because the very nature of the stuff that makes up this creature changes. Well, Paul is saying here, you can get a renewal. You can be transformed. Your life can be transformed. by the renewing of your mind. That's a powerful, powerful concept, isn't it? Now, you know, there's a saying that came out with computers, and, you know, as we now it's not quite as true, but the saying was junk in, junk out, or you only get out what you put in, and that's used for everything, right? Exercise, you're only going to get out of exercise what you put in. If you want to be in good shape, you want to be in good health, you've got to put time in getting exercise of some kind. If you don't, you're not going to get out what you want to, the good health, the ability to engage in life in a positive way. Junk in, junk out. So, what goes into your mind? If we're going to be transformed by the renewing of our mind, what goes into our mind? And that just brings up a lot of questions. Now, how many hours of television do you watch? One study that I read said the average American spends 44 hours per week in front of the TV. Can you imagine 44 hours a week? And what do you watch when you watch it? What do you put in your mind? You know, junk in, junk out. Write stuff in, write stuff out. What do you read? What kind of books do you read? Magazines? What kind of movies do you go to? Do you spend time in the Word of God? Time in worship? Time in fellowship with other believers? What are you putting into your life? What are you putting into your mind? Many years ago, like it was 1933, a man named Ellis came up with this idea of what he calls cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, the big question is, can anybody change? You know, you say you try to change your kids. You can't change your kids. But he found that people could change their behavior and have different emotions if he could start with their heads. Put in the right thoughts. What we think affects how we feel and act. And then what we feel affects how we act. That's what our behaviors can affect our thoughts. And one of the simple examples is a little kid sitting by himself, lonely in school. And he says, I'm sitting here and nobody's looking at me. Something must be wrong with me. And so he gets into a deep depression. And so Ellis begins working with him and begins to help him think a different way. Maybe there's a different way of thinking about this. And so he begins to think maybe it's just because they're on their phones. And so he begins to help this boy think differently about the whys and the wherefores. And so rather than the depression, he says, we've got to try some different behaviors. And so he tries different behaviors. He tries going up to people and sitting with them during lunchtime. And he finds he's making friends. But the idea is what we think affects our behaviors and our emotions. And it's a circle like that. So what do you put into your life in your thinking, in your mind? What do you put in your mind? Now, the sad thing is we don't spend enough time in prayer. We don't spend enough time in reading God's Word, putting that into our lives. In our society today where I am, maybe it's that way where you are too. Maybe it's you. The question is, what do you put in? Because what you put in is what you'll get out. And if you're putting in the pattern of this world, that's what you're going to get out. One of the examples for me is C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. England, back in the 1930s, 40s is when he lived, till the 50s, I believe he died. He's written so many wonderful things, great books for you to read. But he talked about how he came to Christ. He was an atheist, he was a communist. And he came to Christ because he started reading some Christian authors. In fact, one of them was with Gordon MacDonald, well-known Christian author in England. And he was amazed to find that somebody with such talent and brilliant mind could be a Christian. So he began reading more and thinking about Christianity and its claims. He read a book by a man named G.K. Chesterton called The Everlasting Man, an explanation of the Christian view of history. And he was impressed. It made sense. And he couldn't stand the thought of being a Christian, so he's trying hard not to think about it. And he'd read other things, and he'd try to put it aside, but he'd put this stuff in his mind. And so this is what he said as he came to conversion. He said, "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet." That's from his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. We put on the helmet of faith, protecting our mind. Because we know that that's how the enemy is going to get in with temptation and doubts and fears. And so we remind ourselves often that this God of salvation, the helmet of salvation, saved us, owns us, loves us. Next time we're going to turn to some of the offensive weapons and how we go on the attack. See you then.